Toyota, the number one consumer choice on the most fuel-efficient automaker, and now during Toyota's number one for a reason event, get 0.9% APR financing on a 2010 Prius.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Given the current NFL lockout, perhaps March Madness is not so mad after all. Ahead on Only a Game, the latest March Sanity news. Also, the Minnesota Timberwolves hunt for something other than the NBA seller, and a report from Cotter, where the social rules may not bend far enough for the expected influx of World Cup tourists in 2022. Also ahead, Jimmy Breslin's perspective on the story of former Brooklyn Dodgers general manager Branch Rickey.
He had taken quite a bit of time and a huge effort and uncanny, brilliant thinking that went down forever in putting a black into baseball.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. For 17 years, Pat Forty wrote for the Louisville Courier-Journal, and even though Louisville was upset by Morehead State on the first full day of the NCAA basketball tournament, he has agreed to speak with me, perhaps because Pat now works for ESPN, or maybe because Kentucky won their first game, or else it's because Morehead State is also in Kentucky. In any case, he joins me now from Tulsa, site of second and third round games in the west and southwest regions of the tournament. Hi, Pat.
Hello, Bill. Happy Madness to you.
Thank you very much. We'll get to Louisville's slip in just a moment, but let's start with some of last night's results, most of which saw the favorites winning, although Marquette, an 11 seed, knocked off Xavier, a 66-55, I think it was. Did that one surprise you?
No, I thought that was one of the two hardest first-round games to predict. I just think, you know, seeding aside, I thought they were pretty evenly matched, and Marquette had played its way into the tournament in the last few weeks, had been playing pretty well, and so I thought that game was going to be a very difficult one.
Talk to me about other noteworthy second-round results.
The Morehead State over Louisville game, which certainly I would say was probably the best combination of shocker and dramatic, with the long shot by DeMonte Harper to win that game. Very memorable last second game between Butler and Old Dominion, with Butler doing it again, kind of reviving what we saw from them last year. Richmond beating Vanderbilt. Several games I thought that on paper looked closer than their seeding indicated, and then turned out to pretty much to be true.
A number 13 seed, Princeton, came awfully close to knocking off number 4, Kentucky. How are Bluegrass State fans holding up under all this?
High anxiety in the home state for me right now, no doubt about it, Bill. It was very close to Louisville and Kentucky, both losing within about an hour of each other, maybe less, and that, I think, would have been nervous breakdown time for everyone. As it is now, I think Kentucky fans can sit back and hope they got their close miss, narrow miss, I should say, out of the way, and now can maybe get on to playing a little bit better. And Louisville fans, I know, are just crushed by that loss to Morehead State.
Virginia Commonwealth fans are going to be upset if we don't at least mention one other upset. They beat Georgetown, a number 6 seed, and they beat them 74-56. Wasn't close at the end.
Yeah, that was impressive. And Georgetown finished the season very poorly. I mean, they backed into this tournament, so I thought they were susceptible to being beaten. But for VCU, which, a lot of people didn't think belonged when this tournament, when the bracket came up on Selection Sunday, for them to have won 2 games now, to have beaten USC and then turn around and pound Georgetown, that's an impressive way to say we belong.
Pat, this was the first year for the so-called first 4 games. Why was it necessary to expand the field from 65 teams to 68? And is anybody going to remember what happened on the Tuesday that began the tournament?
Well, I think the only way we remembered is if VCU's still playing another week from now. Because they were part of that first four. But otherwise, I don't think so. And why was it necessary? Probably so we could have more commercials for, you know, cars and life insurance and baking soda and whatever else it is that CBS could get money for. I mean, honestly, those games were not very good. The teams are not very good, with the exception, I guess, of VCU. I didn't think, the basketball was not very good. So the first four to me, while certainly better than having a 96-team tournament, was not a great addition to the American sporting culture.
Pat, which round of 32 games should people be paying specific attention to this weekend?
Oh, there's, going to be several really interesting ones, but I think in Tampa, in a rematch of last year's regional final game, you've got West Virginia against Kentucky, and Bob Huggins, who has a great record against John Calipari, and see if he can pull that upset again there. In Tulsa on Sunday, we're going to have Kansas against Illinois, and Kansas last year lost at this stage. It was in a shocking upset. Illinois is the place where Kansas coach Bill Self was before he went there. And I know the Illinois fans are, really, really anxious for a shot at him there. Another way, I'm really interested to see Duke's Kyrie Irving, who's back from the toe injury, playing again on Sunday. And if he's really going to be able to be a major contributor, then does anybody else even need to bother trying to play? Because I think that could make Duke two steps better than everybody else.
Well, you're making me feel very good, because as I reached around in my hat to make my picks for the bracket, I did come out with Duke winning, so maybe I'll be okay this year.
Hey, you know what? Never a bad idea to go with Mike Krzyzewski. He's certainly won more NCAA tournament games than anybody else, but if he's playing as well as he did Friday, then I think everybody else look out.
You can read Pat Forde's 40-yard dash column on ESPN's website. He joined us from Tulsa, site of men's second and third round play. Pat, thanks very much for speaking with me.
All right, Bill, thank you.
From 1949 to 1954, the Minneapolis Lakers won five NBA championships, which means that Minneapolitans have been waiting for their next NBA title for 57 years. The Minnesota Timberwolves moved into town 29 years after the Lakers departed and proceeded to post twice as many losing seasons as winning ones. Though fans have been buoyed by the recent performance of forward Kevin Love, who last week broke a modern-day NBA record for consecutive double-doubles, the team dwells perilously close to the bottom of the league standings. From Minneapolis, Todd Melby reports.
It's a few minutes before tip-off at Target Center, the home of the Minnesota Timberwolves. On this night, the lowly Wolves are playing the defending champion LA Lakers. Wolves players are gathered in a hallway outside the locker room. All-star Kevin Love tells his teammates the obvious. He really, really wants to beat the Lakers.
Guys, nothing would make me happier. nothing. So get this blue shit. Blue shit on 3, 1, 2, 3. Blue shit.
Love didn't go home a happy man that night. The Wolves lost by 11. They remain near the basement in the NBA. The only team with a worse record is Cleveland. Last year was bad, too. The Wolves ended the season with the second worst record in the league. In fact, the team hasn't had a winning record for 8 years, which has prompted some fans to nickname the team the Timber Pups. On this night, there are more Minnesotans wearing Laker jerseys than Wolves jerseys to the game, including fan Tez Shaw. He's sporting a Kobe Bryant jersey.
I ride with the Timberwolves. I just like Kobe because he's my man.
On other nights, Shaw says he wears T-Wolves attire. He thinks the Wolves have a bright future.
The Timberwolves, give them about 2 more years, they'd be there. You know what I mean? I think we need one more point guard. We get the point guard, I think we're good. And another big man besides Kevin Love, and we'll go to the top.
Of course, Shaw's optimism is out of fans of losing teams everywhere. If management can just sign one free agent and that young prospect lives up to expectations, we're a winner. Well, in this case, the man responsible for helping make Shaw's hoop dreams come true is general manager David Kahn. Minnesota hired him a little less than 2 years ago.
When I arrived here, The Timberwolves the previous season were 2-27 against Western Conference playoff teams. That means you're not competitive with the best teams in your conference. And I thought what we needed to do was actually take a step back first and become a little bit younger, much more athletic, much more talented.
The Wolves are definitely younger. Kevin Love and three other players, Michael Beasley, Johnny Flynn, and Anthony Randolph, are barely old enough to buy a drink at a bar, a fact not lost on Khan.
These kids should be seniors in college and not necessarily achieving greatness yet at the NBA level, but I love their potential. And when you think about what Kevin, and I guess to a lesser extent, Michael, have already achieved at this early stage of their career, it really is encouraging for the future.
Against the Lakers, the newly acquired Randolph thrills the crowd by finishing off an alley-oop with a dramatic dunk. Despite the flash of brilliance, the lanky Randolph, he's 6'11 and just 225, got beat up in the paint by the Laker big man. He scores only 4 points on the night, which prompted reporters to ask Timberwolves coach Kurt Rambis about the team's lack of big men.
You really want my wish list? I have one. Is that it?
Okay.
If you watch the game, I think it's fairly evident.
Perhaps Rambis wishes he had players like former Minnesota star Kevin Garnett. From 1995 to 2007, Garnett led the team to the playoffs 8 times. In 2004, they made it to the Western Conference Finals, only to lose, you guessed it, to the Lakers. Not everyone agrees that the team needs more talent. With the 4th pick in the NBA draft last year, the T-Wolves picked Wesley Johnson of Syracuse. He thinks the Wolves will get better with time.
The pieces are here. I just think we just got to continue.
Sid Hartman is a columnist with the Minneapolis Star Tribune. He says things started to go bad for the franchise when the team circumvented the salary cap in 2000, drawing the ire of the NBA.
What really killed this team was is when Glenn Taylor got in trouble and they lost 5 number 1 draft choices. From that day on, it's been a very tough deal. You lose 5 number 1 draft choices, and they got one back, and then that same year, Stern barred both McHale and Taylor, the owner of the team, from being around here. And when you do that, and then the other big mistake they made, they had a heck of a coach in Flip Saunders. He'd gone to the finals of the Western Division the year before they fired him. And the only reason he didn't beat the Lakers that year, Sam Cassell got hurt. Otherwise, they'd have been in the championship, maybe won the whole thing.
Oh! Bynum, you know that was clean!
18-year-old Nick Kaus is watching the game with friends. He wishes management hadn't chosen guards Johnny Flynn and Spanish phenom Ricky Rubio in recent drafts.
The draft picks have been really off the past couple of years. I mean, you don't really usually draft 2 point guards. When all you need is one to be your future, you know what I mean? When Rubio comes, he's going to take Flynn's spot. We're obviously going to have to trade him.
Still, Kaus is willing to stick with his team.
If you're a Timberwolves fan, you're obviously going to be patient. We've been losing the past 4 seasons. So, I mean, you can't really expect anything more. So, hopefully it gets better.
For Only a Game, I'm Todd Melby.
Oh, rebound.
Yeah, here we go, baby!
It's 19 minutes past the hour. On Monday, an enormous digital clock counting down the seconds until the 2012 Olympics was unveiled in London's Trafalgar Square. It seemed like a good idea until the following day, when only 500 days, 7 hours, 6 minutes, and 56 seconds before the Olympics, the clock stopped. "We are very disappointed," said a spokesperson for the Omega Company, which had built the clock. "So are we," said various athletes. "Now how are we going to know when to come to London?" "Don't worry," said the Omega spokesperson. "We've got people working on it now." "Okay," said the athletes, and they returned to their training.
Time stands still. I guess it always will. Since I don't have you by my side.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, the week's sports news with Charlie Pierce. But first, soccer's governing body awarded the 2022 FIFA World Cup to Qatar last December.
The Middle East emirate of about 1.5 million inhabitants is the smallest nation to host the tournament since Uruguay had the honor in 1930. The winning bid included plans for 9 brand-new air-conditioned stadiums that will be dismantled and shipped to developing nations after the tournament. Few doubt the ability of Qatar to provide the infrastructure necessary for a successful World Cup, but some question whether the tiny Persian Gulf nation is willing or able to bend its strict social rules to accommodate international fans accustomed to more freedoms. Only a Game's Ken Shulman was recently in Qatar, and he has this report.
On most days, Doha is wrapped in a cloud of desert dust. But on this January afternoon, the air is clear. From the deck of this rickety restored dhow, in the late afternoon sun, the shimmering towers of the Qatari capital look like a postmodern promised land. Along the starboard bow, a man wearing a black leather jacket over a traditional white robe pours tea from a thermos for his wife and 2 kids. He sees me, pours another cup, and brings it to me. I nod to thank him. He nods back. I nod to thank his wife. She looks away.
You've got to be very careful. You can't take a picture of a woman, for example, without getting her permission. Even by mistake, taking someone's picture, you can be put in jail.
Matthew Lorimer is an independent contractor who helped Qatar stage the opening ceremonies for the 2006 Asian Games, a regional athletic competition. He says there are many things Western fans will need to know when they come to Qatar in 2022.
When we were managing the ceremonies for the Asian Games, I got a good half a dozen guys out of jail for drinking. They'd had drinks at some club and they were walking home and they were arrested. You know, it's that simple. Before I could get there, they'd been blood tested and slapped in jail.
Qatar is a teardrop-shaped spit of desert, not quite as large as Connecticut, jutting into the Persian Gulf. The country is ruled by an emir. There's no parliament, no popular elections. Free speech is protected so long as you don't discuss anything controversial. Blessed with enormous deposits of natural gas and oil, the Mideast monarchy went from Bedouin camps and pearl diving to skyscrapers and sovereign wealth funds in just over 2 decades. As the world witnessed during this January's Asia Cup soccer tournament, Qatar has the means to import materials and talent from anywhere on the globe. One glance at the skyline, a sort of murderer's row of international architecture, suggests that building 9 new stadiums for 2022 will be a cakewalk. And even though temperatures can top 130 degrees here in summer, Qatar won't have to worry about the gas bill to keep them cool. The real question is, how will this still insular country deal with a month-long invasion of fans from all over the world, many of whom can't even spell Sharia? Foreigners with whom the only thing they share is a passion for soccer.
Most thing is absence, no participation in politics, no participation in public. So the soccer has become so big, and people want to be part of it.
Khalid Al-Jabo is a Qatar native completing his doctorate in the UK. He's a little miffed because officials at this first-round Asia Cup match between Japan and Syria sent him to the wrong parking lot, even though he had the right pass, then to the wrong gate, even though he had the right ticket, and then they gave away his seat. This sort of thing happens a lot here. A former journalist, Al-Jaber hopes the 2022 World Cup will push his country to bone up on customer service. Even more, he hopes it will inspire the entire region towards real political and social change.
I hope the perspective and stereotype of Arabs changing when Qatar hold the World Cup, and more Arab countries open for the world and accept the democracy and open the politics and respect the human being life and human rights. So I hope this is all changing for the 10 years from now until 2022.
I asked Al-Jaber what the 2022 World Cup might be like for Western women or for gays. In the days following Qatar's successful bid, FIFA President Sepp Blatter suggested that gays refrain from having sex when they visit Qatar in 2022, a remark he'd later recanted.
Do you go to jail here for homosexuality?
I don't think so. Maybe you get warned because it's like, it's not allowed because you have a law.
Oh.
Friday is the Muslim holy day. Locals go to pray at one of the city's many mosques. Unlike Saudi Arabia, its neighbor to the west, Qatar does tolerate other faiths. Christians in Doha worship on Friday as well, at the still unfinished multi-church complex rooted in desert sands on the western edge of the city, just past the single store where registered foreigners can buy alcohol. In the distance, on a clear day, you can see the towers that hold the capital's 48-hour water supply. This service is Orthodox, with readings in Arabic, Serbian, English, and Greek. Qatar's winning $65 billion World Cup bid includes various infrastructure items along with stadiums, a new airport, a seaport, a new city for the final, and a 25-mile bridge to Bahrain. Although given what's gone on there, they might want to rethink that one. The work will be done by men like these, some of the nearly 1 million migrant workers who live in Qatar. Albert Dantes arrived last year from the Philippines on a 2-year permit. He shares a bedroom with 7 other men, sends most of his salary home, and needs his employer's permission to change jobs or leave the country. On most Fridays, Dantes meets his friends here on the Corniche, Doha's looping seaside promenade, where they smoke, play music, and relax. It's one of the few places they're allowed to go.
You cannot go to the shopping mall in Friday because they said this is their family day. I said, every Filipino have one right, or every people in the world have rights just to buy his things. You didn't have a wife here. If police catch you, you will go to jail. This is the bad thing here in Qatar.
Lots of other places are off limits for single men here on weekends. The major squares, the family section and restaurants. But the truth is, they're off limits for single men of color. European and American men enter freely. They enjoy certain privileges that other foreigners don't.
You know what, Qatari, they are afraid from the white color skin, from the Europeans, from the Americans, you know, they were afraid. Yes, and like Filipino, they treat us Filipinos as slaves.
While migrant workers spend their free days on the Corniche or in squares on the outskirts of Doha, Qataris take to the desert. Every weekend, thousands of them flock to camps like this one, an hour or so outside of Doha. Make sure you go with the local, though. The roads and rotaries are unmarked. There are rides and games for the kids, a Bedouin tent with tea and traditional sweets, and huge sand dunes that drivers charge at with their jeeps and dune buggies. It's loud, chaotic, and dangerous. Half a dozen injured people are airlifted back to Doha every weekend. In the evenings, the main gathering place for locals is the newly rebuilt Souq Waqif, with its spice shops, restaurants, and stores selling parakeets, pigeons, and doves. At this outdoor shisha cafe, patrons draw on water pipes while the Asia Cup soccer match between India and Bahrain plays on a large wall screen with the sound turned off. The souq is usually quiet, the way the Qataris like it. But things are getting just a little wild in this fan zone outside the walls. It's a Debka party, with Syrian fans churning it up on the limestone dance floor. It doesn't matter that they lost to Japan the night before. The pulsing bass and pounding drums drive the rhythm, while the singer spins a sweet tale of love at first sight between a boy and a girl. A few Qataris join the fun, twirling and grinding beneath their headdresses. Of course, there isn't any alcohol, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, given the damage drunken soccer fans are capable of. But there also aren't any women. It's noon on Saturday. The midday prayer call wafts through Doha's landmark mall. Judging from the reaction, it seems more a call to shop or brunch, as Westerners and Qataris continue on their way to Paul's French Cafe, or Starbucks, or the Body Shop. The shopping mall has a special place in Qatari culture, an indoor paradise of plenty in a land where it's just too darn hot for most of the year. Mohamed Blouchi is an archaeologist. He knows from experience that all cultures change when they open to others. sometimes gradually, and sometimes very quickly, and that this change isn't always welcome. He also knows that a global event like the World Cup will have a huge impact on Qatar.
I think it's good. We'll give something good to my country. They will. Many people will know my country, and the country here will be changing many things, okay? But at the same time, many people, like an old people, they are afraid what will happen, what will change, how we'll accept this change that's coming to my country, it's good or bad. Many people, they are afraid, and at the same time, many people is happy. And we don't know what will happen until 2022.
The generous salaries and benefits Qatar offers its 300,000 citizens have so far insulated the emirate from the shockwaves toppling regimes across the Middle East. Politically, Qatar is closer to the West than it is to Saudi Arabia, with whom it shares its only land border. Socially, the country stands about halfway between Riyadh and Las Vegas, with bright lights, stern laws, and a population that clamors for more fun, if not more freedoms. The World Cup may well bring some of both, for citizens, guest workers, and visitors alike. Because it's clear that when it wants to, Qatar can throw a heck of a party. For Only a Game, I'm Ken Shulman.
A lot of people, even a lot of sports fans, may not have noticed that Major League Soccer's 16th regular season opened on Tuesday night. But 36,443 people in Seattle were aware of the occasion in person. Unhappily for most of them, the team they had showed up to support, the Seattle Sounders, fell to the visiting Los Angeles Galaxy 1-0. David Beckham didn't score, neither did Landon Donovan. The Galaxy won anyway. The remaining MLS teams will begin their seasons this weekend, and those remaining teams include newcomers Portland and Vancouver, which means that in 7 years, MLS has grown from 10 to 18 teams. If you are confident that Major League Soccer will prevail, you regard that expansion, as well as the anticipated addition of a team in Montreal next season, as evidence that all is proceeding according to plan. Or, at least according to whatever plan, a league that keeps changing size and altering its all-star game format and playoff arrangements can be said to have. My favorite early season stories both involve the team in Kansas City. They started out in 1996 as the Wiz, which still ranks as the dumbest choice of team name in the history of organized sports. The team belatedly recognized their folly and became the Wizards, but that didn't work either because this season they are Sporting Kansas City. Choice 3 suggests that the Kansas City team, like DC United and FC Dallas, wish to invoke in its name the echoes of various more established clubs in countries where soccer has a higher profile. I'm okay with that, although some of the people in the Only a Game office regard it as pretentious, weird, and stupid. Apparently operating on the assumption that a team that keeps changing their name should have at least one player who keeps changing his name, next week Sporting Kansas City will stage a tryout for Chad Ochocinco, a.k.a. Chad Johnson, and briefly Chad Hachigo. Mr. Ochocinco announced this week that he uses a soccer ball when he warms up for NFL practices and games, and he also said, "Due to the NFL lockout, I'm excited to be able to follow my childhood dream of playing for a Major League Soccer team." Evidence, I suppose, that although most people certainly consider the lockout an ill wind, it has blown Sporting KC and Senor Ochocinco some potentially good publicity. The tryout will last 4 days, unless the dream dies prematurely. You're listening to Only a Game. Harry Irwin, who hears Only a Game on WBUR, has been thinking sports and business. He emailed to say, "While listening to my two favorite NPR shows, Marketplace and Only a Game, I heard the phrases corporate merger and NFL lockout. Has it occurred to anyone but me that all the unions for pro athletes should merge? They all discuss the same issues, salary cap, drug testing, health care, etc. The combined unions could place their full force behind negotiations with each group of owners. After they get their own house in order, maybe they could unionize college athletics and help remedy that outrageously unfair system. Sally Kirshner was unhappy with Charlie Pierce's comment about Brigham Young University's suspension of a basketball player for violating BYU's honor code. "Did I hear Charlie compare BYU to the former East Germany?" Ms. Kirshner wrote. "Not a good idea. That type of commentary only provides fodder for the conservatives to continue their blasting of NPR. Could Mr. Pierce not veer toward the Glenn Beck style of wildly inappropriate statements? Why invite trouble?" Meanwhile, Tom Kufel emailed to say he thinks Charlie would be a natural choice to voice the squawk of the Affleck duck.
Affleck!
Brent Mellon enjoyed my conversation 2 weeks ago with Phil Sutherland, who co-founded cycling's Team Type 1, in part to publicize how athletes with diabetes can control their disease and compete at cycling's highest level. "Thank you for finally doing a positive story on competitive cycling," Mr. Mellon wrote. "Team Type 1 is a great example of what you can do with determination despite adverse medical conditions. I hope to hear other stories that show the positive side of cycling on your show." Richard Danka enjoyed last week's conversation with St. Peter's basketball coach John Dunn. "More of this, please," he wrote. "We can get the focus on pro sports anywhere, but no one else would give us this giddy coach." You can comment on stories and conversations you've heard on Only a Game by calling the listener line, 617-353-1860. You can contact us through our website, onlyagame.org, and every once in a while we still get a letter or a postcard addressed to Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, and I gather the staff around me when that happens, and we all read together. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose summer school has courses for high school, college, and adults to earn academic credit and experience campus life, summer.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
In honor of March Madness, a Maryland television station has staged Mascot Madness 2011. The competition pitted Screech of the Washington Nationals, Slapshot of the Washington Capitals, and T-Rec of the Montgomery County Department of Recreation against each other and eight other furry creatures with gigantic heads. The mascot stumbled up and down the court, occasionally managing to clumsily fling the basketball into the hoop. When all the fake fur had flown, Claude, C-L-A-W-E-D, the mascot for American University, emerged the winner. The Battling Baron of Chevy Chase High and Jack the Bulldog of Georgetown University have both been suspended from further competition for swearing at the officials. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Jimmy Breslin, one of the more celebrated columnists of our time, talks about his new book, Branch Rickey. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Upsets started early in this year's NCAA tournament. On Thursday, number 13 Morehead State kicked things off by topping number 4 Louisville. But the first full day of the tournament could have been worse for bracketologists out there. At least another number 4, Kentucky, managed to hold off 13th seed Princeton.
Yeah, it was a terrific first day. I mean, you had two or three really close games. The Morehead State game was terrific. In fact, we were confronting the possibility that the only team from the state of Kentucky left in the tournament after the first day would be Morehead State. But Kentucky managed to get a layup to beat Princeton. Besides the fact that my brackets are already starting to, you know, thin out a bit on
yours
the edges
and everybody else's. The women's tournament gets underway today. Stanford beat UConn this season, but UConn hasn't lost since. Tennessee beat Stanford, but Baylor beat Tennessee, and Baylor has Brittany Griner, maybe the most dominant player in the college game, even though they lost to UConn. So, you want to make some picks?
Yes, Connecticut's going to win the tournament. I don't care about all that other stuff. UConn's going to win the tournament.
You heard it here.
I would like to
first,
see,
last, and always.
I would like to see UConn play Tennessee for the national championship just for the historical significance of it. UConn's much better than all those teams.
In a new documentary, former Michigan star Jalen Rose called black players at Duke in the early 90s Uncle Toms, and former Duke star Grant Hill responded in the New York Times, said that Rose's sentiment was, quote, sad and somewhat pathetic. Is there anything we can take away from this very public debate?
You know, Bill, it's at moments like these where I remember the words of Adam Clayton Powell, who said, beware of Greeks bearing gifts and white men who understand the Negro. I mean, this is one of those issues where I feel very delicate stepping in. I do think Jalen Rose's comments were misinterpreted. He really was saying the way he felt when he was 18. But you got to love, first of all, you got to love Grant Hill for having the juice to get his reply in the New York Times. And second of all, the last sentence of his response was, and I am proud I never lost a game against the Fab Five. Nah, no one's really bothered by this.
Jim Tressel, the football coach at Ohio State, was only supposed to serve a 2-game suspension for failing to report that his players had sold Ohio State memorabilia, but he has asked to serve 5 games to match the punishment levied on the players. Charlie, I might be a cynic here, but I can't help wondering if this is Tressel's way of making sure those 5 losses at the beginning of next season get credited to some assistant.
Well, it's also a very cynical public relations maneuver because the original penalty was pretty much hooted out of existence for its leniency. You know, 5 games is better than 3. This is still pretty serious, and how Ohio State can continue to employ somebody who lied to it institutionally is still beyond me.
At the NHL General Managers meeting on Monday, Commissioner Gary Bettman introduced what he called, quote, a 5-step plan to reduce concussions. So, evaluate steps 1 through 5 for me, please.
The new 5-step plan is so chock full of common sense that people who don't follow the NHL will be amazed that that most of this stuff isn't being done in the first place, especially the part about having the player assessed by a doctor and not an athletic trainer, eh? Wouldn't you figure people would have started doing that by now?
Max Pacioretty, the Canadiens winger who suffered a concussion and a cracked vertebra on March 8th when Zdeno Chara of the Bruins knocked him into a stanchion, is reportedly trying to come back for the playoffs. Do you suppose I'm alone in hoping Mr. Pacioretty will take at least the next few months off?
No, you're not even alone in this studio in hoping that. I hope he doesn't come back. I hope Montreal refuses to let him come back. And if Montreal won't step up, I hope the NHL refuses to let him come back.
Barry Bonds, whose trial will begin on Monday, will not have to worry that voicemails he left on his mistress's phone machine will be used against him. Do those voicemails have anything to do with charges of perjury against Bonds?
No, it had everything to do with the prosecution attempting to paint Barry Bonds as a thoroughgoing slimeball and demolish his reputation before it gets to a jury. So I'm very happy that the judge has denied their relevance and will keep them out of the trial.
On Tuesday, John Baker mushed his sled dogs across the finish line in Nome before anybody else could get there, and so he and those dogs won the Iditarod. Does it strike you as odd that when you win the Iditarod, what you get is a truck?
That is rather odd, but I mean, I ask this question every year at the end of the Iditarod. What do the dogs get? They
mush.
Did all the freaking work. Do they get a truck?
Mushing
do they
mush.
Get 50 G's worth of, you know, Purina dog chow?
I had promised myself that I would not ask you anything about the NFL lockout this week, but I can't help but wonder whether you agreed with Commissioner Goodell's sentiment when he said, it would be a terrible shame if the Players Association sabotaged the league's draft because it is, quote, a special moment.
Yes, especially for those in the Kuiper household. Otherwise, unless you are a complete drone, no. And this is, of course, Roger Goodell's attempt to separate the players of the future from the players of the present. As though, by the way, his rookie wage scale won't do that in the first place.
At least 2 NFL players signed with Arena Football League teams this week. Rod Windsor of the Browns and Troy Bergeron of the Cowboys. And Chad Ochocinco, a.k.a. Chad Johnson, will try out for the MLS Sporting Kansas City team next week. Is this a trickle that could become a flood?
Well, I don't think so, although it's being portrayed as such by people who want the management side to win this, which is practically everyone who covers the NFL. I'm really fascinated by this Ochocinco thing. If you're MLS, and considering now that we have a generation of young athletes who probably grew up at one point or another playing soccer, aren't you encouraging this? Aren't you begging you know, NFL stars to come play for your team. I hope Ocho Cinco plays. I hope he scores. I hope he scores a goal in his first game and whips out the Sharpie and autographs the ball. I mean,
and
it's not like
probably let him.
I mean, it's not like there's a rule against garish celebrations in soccer.
And finally, knowing how much you appreciate new world records,
sports,
I want to bring to your attention the achievement of a fellow who calls himself Professor Splash. He dove off a 36-foot tower into a child's paddling pool.
And he says the secret is not doing something incredibly insane like jumping 35 feet into a foot of water. It's making sure the water is really cold. I would say the secret is not missing the wading pool, because then you would be Professor Splat.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America and various other books as well, and his profile of Ryan Westmoreland, a Red Sox prospect returning to baseball after brain surgery, appears this Sunday in the Boston Globe magazine. Charlie joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, my friend.
Thanks, Bill.
Jimmy Breslin has written an awful lot of newspaper columns and many books, too, and in the most recent of the latter, he characterizes Jackie Robinson's entry into Major League Baseball as, quote, Branch Rickey's assault on ignorance. It's a great phrase in a book with lots of them, and a book with lots of perspective on what the man known to his players as Mr. Rickey and to many writers as the Mahatma accomplished. Joining me now from NPR's New York Bureau is Jimmy Breslin. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
Branch Rickey essentially invented baseball's farm system, which you write at one point was, quote, modeled somewhat after the Southern system of slavery. Some irony there, I guess.
It was, what'd I say, somewhat?
Yeah.
Precisely after the slavery system, and for a reason. Rickey had changed the world by putting a black in a baseball. But while he was at it, then he developed a farm system. Baseball players all over the country who were signed and then sold. You couldn't keep them all. He had 500 ball players. So he sold them. He could sell a guy for $10,000. Rickey took 10%. There was no such thing as an agent in those days. So Rickey took that role. It was a big thing. Money in his pocket.
One of the allies Branch Rickey needed in his plan to bring Robinson to the Dodgers was George V. McLaughlin, the president of the Brooklyn Trust Company, to which institution the Dodgers owed $800,000 at the time.
That's right.
Having heard Branch Rickey's plan, Mr. McLaughlin said something like, don't try to bring principle into this. If this doesn't work for money, you're sunk. This,
you write
that this made Branch Rickey tingle. Why?
Well, because that was exactly what you knew would bring the man over to your side. Get paid. Let me tell you about McLaughlin. Rickey brings up the fact they could make money together with a black ball player. It took McLaughlin a minute and 2 seconds to see how the black could start to bring large crowds into Ebbets Field stands. And why this is a wonderful idea, black coming into baseball. Let's do it. That took care of racism.
As long as they could make a profit, racism was dead.
I can pay rent. What are you talking about?
Jackie Robinson didn't join the Brooklyn Dodgers until the spring of 1947. But how long before that did Branch Rickey begin planning to integrate Major League Baseball?
Branch Rickey lived at Forest Hills Gardens, Queens. And in late 1943-44, the minister at the Protestant church 2 blocks away was drafted, and there was nobody there. Rickey picked up a Bible, mounted the steps to the pulpit, and delivered a sermon to an audience of women, elderly women. Their husbands were away in the army. Everybody was gone. There was a war. one time he finally said that, I am going to change things in Brooklyn. I am going to place a black in the National Baseball League. You're not to say anything about this till the war is over, because we can't have it. People are being excited by this race thing when your husbands are not here to handle it. And the women all said they would say nothing. And they didn't say a word. And he called Clyde Sukforth from Maine to come down. He had been a catcher and a scout. He asked Sukforth to go to Chicago and get this Jackie Robinson. So Sukforth went out there and didn't know one black from the other. They went to the offices of the Brooklyn Dodgers at 215 Montague Street, went upstairs, what was it, to the fourth floor, where Ricky sat in a big office. And Ricky said, do you know why we brought you here? And Robinson said, to play for black baseball team, I guess. And Ricky said, no, that isn't why we brought you here. We brought you here to play for the Brooklyn Dodgers. And that left Robinson in shock. He could barely talk for the next 3 hours as Ricky assaulted him and imitated whites turning him away from restaurants, abused him. He spent the whole afternoon, at the conclusion of which Ricky had him sign a contract with the Brooklyn organization. It was done. That's it.
I'd like to ask you to read just a short passage from the book. It's the beginning of the story of scout Clyde Sukforth's trip to watch Jackie Robinson play when he was with the Kansas City Monarchs. Yeah.
Clyde Sukforth's business trip by train to Chicago was so much more than a search for a baseball player. He was not traveling merely to see a baseball player, even a great player, for even these are merely bodies that one day run fast and then run slow before fading into memory.
After you came up with that, merely bodies that one day run fast and then run slow before fading into memory, did you hesitate before writing the rest of that paragraph?
No.
No.
You can't. You're doing this for a living, this writing. Come on, write it. You got to get paid here.
In 1947, Dodgers games were brought to radio listeners by Red Barber. He was, of course, beloved then and much beloved in later years by public radio listeners. He used to be on with Bob Edwards.
Yeah, but he started off silly, Southern silly. He had been around growing up, Ku Klux Klan rallies where they tarred and feathered blacks. And now he was in Brooklyn as the announcer, mm-hmm. and Ricky called him in. Ricky told him, I'm going to place a black Jackie Robinson in baseball. Barber went home in shock and said he was going to have to quit. He couldn't announce a black, not from where he came from. So he got home in Scarsdale, Westchester County, and he told his wife, and she listened. I'm living in a nice house here in Scarsdale, a suburb. She said, well, we ought to have a drink before you call. So she made him a martini with nothing in it but liquor and some ice. He had it, and then he held out his glass. He'd have another one. She had it in her mind to give him 20 drinks, if that's what it was going to take. But the minute he took the second drink, she knew that once again, good, decent alcohol was overcoming ignorance. And they would have no more thoughts of leaving over Jackie Robinson coming into baseball.
Yeah, you write that it was a good thing that Lila Barber was an adult. And I think that's probably
it. Yes, that's what she was. You know, what is this foolishness? We're going to give up this house because of a black baseball player he doesn't want? Come on, have a drink.
As you point out in the book, Branch Rickey was a man of many facets. He was a powerful agent of change who saw no problem with profiting from his good works, nor was he shy about educating people about his own significance. Finally, all of these things considered, how should people regard Branch Rickey today?
As Robinson stepped out of a dugout and put a spiked shoe on the National League baseball field's grass, the country shook and changed immediately. A hand was behind him on the back of Jackie Robinson and shoved him onto the field to change America forever.
Jimmy Breslin has written a great many books, the most recent of which is Branch Rickey, published by Viking. The author joined me from NPR in New York. Jimmy Breslin, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Good.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Mark Filippino, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Ken Shulman's Cotter Photo Gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Jimmy Breslin, who confirms that Jersey City's unofficial motto used to be, not guilty.
That's it. That was a very important phrase.
Yes, and I've heard that Hoboken's unofficial motto was, don't look at me, I didn't do it either. I'm Bill Littlefield, and I come from New Jersey. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.